We cover all sorts of conditions that are disabling to children, from children who are recognised at birth to have a disability, through to children who are later recognised to have a problem that's always been present, through to children who become disabled as a result of illness or injury.
And so these are then children who, some of them just in short-term care, or they're going to need contact through much of their lives?
For some of the children we see, it's possible to assess them, make a diagnosis, make some recommendations as to what interventions they need and send them on their way. But for the vast majority of the children we see, we end up following them up in the longer term, particularly the children who have more severe disabilities.
It must be quite an adjustment for parents or caregivers to learn at the start that there's something going on that they're perhaps going to have with them for the rest of their lives.
I think there's a huge adjustment for them. It really depends also on their own experience. So, for instance, some families may have already had experience of disability. We see parents who perhaps have a sibling who's had a disability, and they're often very well aware of the stresses that are going to face them in the future. And we see other parents who've never even crossed their mind that they might have a child who is not entirely normal. And, you know, that can often be a huge adjustment for them.
What sort of help is provided to them initially to get them to accept and, I suppose, tune into the job that they have?
For children who are recognised to have a disability at birth, either because some difficulty has happened during the birth process or in the neonatal unit, or who are recognised to have a condition at the outset, such as Down syndrome, they would be informed of the diagnosis and of the potential problems by the team looking after them at that time. And they would also almost certainly be offered contact with one of the social workers on the newborn unit, who would discuss the implications of the diagnosis with them and outline to them the services that would be available. Where it's known that there is a child with a disability, our team likes to get involved at that stage, because I think it's often very helpful for parents when they leave the neonatal unit to have actually met the person who is going to be their child's paediatrician in the longer term.
Where it's a child that is going to need long-term or lifetime care, what are the main sort of pressures that the caregiver or the parents or the family tend to face along the way?
I think most parents and caregivers would say the biggest pressure they face is finding their way around the system and fighting with the system. The system of support is actually very, very complicated. And for families to actually know all the things which are available to support them in the care of their child is actually very difficult. And of course, we have two different systems. We have the ACC system to support people whose disability is shown to be the result of an accident, and we have the disability support system where, for instance, the disability is the result of an illness. So we might have, for instance, a child, we might have a couple of children in the ward, for instance, one who has had a head injury as a result of, say, falling from a tree, and another child in the next bed may have had a stroke. People are sometimes surprised to hear that children have strokes. Fortunately, it's rare, but they do. The problems those children may have may be very similar, but the range of supports that are available to them and where the support will come from is completely different.
And does one have an easier journey than the other, or are they just different?
I think they're different. One of the frustrations for people who work in the sector and people with disability is that ACC is generally well-resourced. That doesn't mean to say that people always find ACC easy to work with, whereas for the people who have received the disability support, there is a smaller pot of money to go around quite a large number of people.
Once they've come to grips with the system, what are the stresses that are most common just in daily life and dealing with the situation that they're in?
It depends very much on the family and what resources they have and what supports they have. So the situation for a family who have good extended family support, grandparents who are healthy and active living locally is very different for example, a solo mother whose parents may be at the other end of the country who doesn't have a good network of people to support her. So personal situations do affect how people cope. I think the two biggest stresses I see are when children have challenging behaviour as a result of their disability, so they may be running away, having tantrums, perhaps kicking holes in walls, and that may well flow over into the school situation, so the parent is dreading the next phone call from school about what their child has done. And for the families who face a child who is getting heavier and heavier and requires lifting because they're totally dependent.
Where there are behavioural issues, is there easy access to support, or is that something that parents and caregivers just have to learn to manage themselves?
There are, in the disability sector, as disability support as opposed to ACC, there are agencies who have contracts with the Ministry of Health to provide intervention for different challenging behaviours. Those services tend to be quite oversubscribed, so sometimes there are long waiting lists.
Which is the area, I guess, that poses most difficulty, where there isn't the easiest answer?
I think perhaps the most difficulty is for those families who have a young person, a child or a young person who's behaviourally challenging, but who also has quite a lot of health issues. So, for example, the children who have severe epilepsy, who may be having frequent epileptic seizures, which require a degree of knowledge for people to cope with just to ensure the child's safety or the young person's safety, and who also have behaviours which are very challenging, which might be related to the underlying brain condition. And sometimes, to be honest, some of the medications that we give actually make the behaviour worse, and then you're in a situation of kind of balance between which is worse, the seizures or the behaviour, and if that's the only medication that works, sometimes you take the trade-off of the behaviour rather than having a child who's fitting a lot of the time.
Does the system provide any sort of time-out facility for parents in those, you know, extremely difficult situations?
There are a couple of options available. One is what is called out-of-home respite. And again, in the disability support sector, that's funded by the ministry, who have contract with agencies that provide that type of respite. And there are also what are called carer support days. My personal prejudice is I don't like the term carer support days because they are a sum of money for 24 hours care. There's been a bit of an increase over the 25 years that I've been working as a developmental paediatrician, but compared with the rise in the cost of living, it's actually quite a small increase. And I think it would be much fairer to say you can buy respite up to this dollar value. You could still put checks and balances in place. But when somebody says, oh, you've got 50 carer support days, it sounds like they're having a pretty easy life. When you discover that a carer support day equals just over $70, and you actually do the sums of how much care that will buy you, it doesn't sound like quite such a cushy life after all. The other thing which is really difficult, I think, in everywhere in New Zealand, perhaps particularly so in Auckland, is that it is difficult to find people to provide carer support. Perhaps the economic downturn will actually be a benefit to some families, because while we've had relatively full employment, there isn't a workforce around to provide that carer support. And that's made things quite difficult. For people who live in more rural areas, travelling to a respite care facility might mean 2 hours in the car with a child who's a bit agitated, and they simply may not be prepared to go there. It may be easier to stay home and not have a break than travel to a respite facility if there's not one available locally.
Having said all that, is the support that's available, has it got better or is it getting better?
I think it varies. It's patchy. There are some excellent places with some excellent dedicated staff, and there are other situations where things are not as good.
So this is geographically patchy?
Geographically and even within geographical areas. So even within Auckland, I might do a clinic and I might talk to families, and the first family I see might be saying, oh, you know, we've got this problem, we've got that problem, we can't find anybody to do the carer support, they offered us this respite facility, we didn't like it, the child came home copying bad habits. And the next family might come in and say, oh, the people at so-and-so are so fantastic, I don't know what I'd do without them. So that's sort of patchy. Mm.
If you could wish for one area of improvement or something new to happen, what would that be?
Oh, that's a hard one. There are many things that I'd like to see improved. I think I would like to see us put more flexibility into the system. At the moment, it seems to me the system is very bound by contracts. So, for instance, if there's somebody's awarded personal care, for instance, they have a 17-year-old with cerebral palsy and they need help with bathing and dressing in the morning, that contract is put with an agency. If that agency can't provide somebody, then the NASC agency, the Needs Assessment Service Coordination Agency, has to wait for that agency to come back to them and say, sorry, we haven't got anyone, before they can put the contract with another agency. So if somebody goes on holiday for a couple of weeks, that family might be just left hanging for a couple of weeks without any support. And they also have very little choice about who can. And it's a very personal thing, having somebody come into your home to provide personal cares. You've really got to feel comfortable on a daily basis about the person who's coming into your home. And I'm not talking about honesty or anything like that. I think we take that as for granted, and everybody is security checked and so on. But it's about someone who actually is happy to do things in the way that fits in with that particular family. It's about adjusting to fit in with that particular family's culture, used in the broadest sense of the word.
What happens in the transition when a child, you know, progresses out of paediatric services into adult services? Is that a smooth...
That's a real headache. I have two or three young people that I'm trying to transition at the moment, and I guess there is no adult equivalent of developmental paediatricians, and in many ways no adult equivalent of general paediatricians, that paediatricians tend to take a holistic view. Because we're used to dealing with children, we expect children to come along with parents and families, whereas in the adult world, adults are expected to be responsible for their own health care. And for many of the children who we need to transition, the young people we need to transition, they actually don't have the resources, the abilities to do that. They need somebody to advocate for them, and that is difficult.
So they're old enough to move into adult or have to move into adult services because of age, but in fact their needs and the types of needs they have don't change.
They don't, and often they have complex needs that actually cut across several different areas of adult services. So they might end up being in multiple different clinics for each bit of them that needs some attention. So they might have a feeding tube into the stomach, a gastrostomy, which might go to the gastroenterologist. They might have a breathing issue, which goes to the respiratory person, and so on. So they might be without anyone holding that together except the GP. And some GPs do this very well and very willingly, but even some of the excellent GPs that I've spoken to say, but, you know, I've only got maybe two people with these kind of needs. It's not something, I need a resource to actually support me. Quite happy to do the care, but they need access to resource and information to help them do it well.
Is that something that's being recognised, or is that pretty well in the hard basket?
It's in the hard basket at the moment, but I think it is something that's being recognised increasingly, yes.
I'm down to ask you something about Section 141 in SIFs. Can you explain just briefly to me what that is?
Section 141, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, was a section that was put into the original Children and Young Persons Act as a protection for children who were placed out of home because of disability. So to make sure that there were safeguards in place, so that if someone was being placed permanently outside their family home because of a disability, that there were checks and balances in place to make sure that that placement was an appropriate and safe placement for that person. I think there have sometimes been some difficulties with Section 141 because it's been felt that a family, for instance, who were saying, we cannot keep doing this anymore, we need an alternative, must go through the child, youth and family process. But I think those relationships have got better over recent years, and child, youth and family do need to be involved, but providing there is a good plan in place, then their role is to make sure that the child will be, or the young person usually, will be looked after well in that placement.
So this is a process that's working better than it has in the past?
I think so. I think things have improved over the last few years. I think people have more understanding of what it's about.
From your own personal perspective, you spent some years in this area. What are the things that kind of keep you going? Is it individual cases, or is it seeing the system change?
You mean, why do I do what I do?
Yeah, I guess what gives you the feeling of...
I guess the feedback that we get from families. It's actually very... A lot of people say, wouldn't it be depressing working with children who have a disability? And I say, well, no, it's not depressing. I don't find it depressing. But I think what is satisfying is when you can ensure that you've helped a family to get an appropriate program in place and that things are working well for that family and that their child is maintained in the best health that they can be so that they are able to learn as much as they can and receive the therapy that they need to overcome their disabilities as far as that is possible.
Effectively sort of seeing them on their way.
Yes, absolutely.
And do you have to put a sort of a wall in there to stop getting emotionally involved, or is that not really an issue?
I think one does need to be careful about boundaries. I personally don't feel it's a major issue. But I do think one does have to be careful about boundaries. But I would say that there would be some families whose children, young people, have well left my care, who I would still go and have a coffee with their mums and catch up on what's happening. Because after all, if you look after a child for 16 or 18 years, you get to know the family very well.
And the families that you start dealing with, the new cases, I mean, do they seem as well equipped for it or as anyone can as those, you know, some years back?
Oh, I think probably better equipped now. I think there are some real advantages. I think the fact that people have access to the internet. Some health professionals, I think, get a little worried about the internet because people come in and ask questions. But one of the perspectives I have is that there are so many different conditions that cause disability. I cannot possibly hold in my head all the different things that need to be known about every condition. Families go and research the internet, bring information in and say, what do you think about this? And I say, I think that's absolutely fine. I think that one needs to view it as a partnership between the professionals, the paediatrician, the therapists, the special education teachers, the mainstream teachers, and the family to provide the best possible service to the child.